Mark, first of all, the Western Golf Association, obviously a long history and great tradition with caddies. Can you tell us a little bit about caddies? And while you were growing up and learning the game, did you ever caddy while you were...
I actually did. I mean, I didn't start playing golf till I was 13, so that's kind of late compared to most young people. But luckily for me, as a young man growing up all around the United States, and I actually lived here in Chicago for a couple different times, when we moved to Southern California when I was 13, we moved above a golf course, went down, just kind of picked up my mom's club, started playing, and next thing you know, I was caddying. So, you know, the caddying aspect of the game was something that was really important to me from the standpoint that I could make a few dollars, but from the also the standpoint of my parents felt pretty secure about where their son was every single day.
Well, when you graduated up to top-level amateur golf and professional golf, obviously you had a caddy on the bag. Can you share some of the experience and maybe the caddy that talk a little bit about that person who was with you out on tour for a long time?
Well, I think it's an important blend to certainly have a good caddy on the bag, somebody that you can trust, somebody that kind of knows you, not only just a player or maybe your tendencies, but certainly as a human being. So, you know, there's a lot of ups and downs when we play the game of golf, no matter what level that you play at. And when you can have a sidekick right alongside of you out there carrying your bag that kind of can motivate you when you need a little bit of motivation or kind of keep you level-headed, I guess, in times of stressful situations and make proper decisions on the golf course, that's really an important facet of a caddy.
Were you able to lock in with somebody pretty quickly, or did you have to go through a few guys so you got comfortable with someone?
No, I'm a pretty loyal guy. You know, it doesn't take a lot for me. I mean, it's important. So the caddies that I've had have not only just been caddies, but they've become pretty much lifelong friends. And from the standpoint that they kind of knew me, you know, like to me, I'm a loyal guy, like I said, but I'm also a guy that, you know, expects people to be on time. You know, if you're on time, and you don't really smoke or have any bad habits, you're going to do fine working for Mark O'Meara on my bag. So, but if you show up late, that's a serious problem because I can't be late.
Do you look out on the tour today? I mean, sometimes we see guys, their girlfriends are caddying, their wives are caddying, their best friend from high school suddenly is on the bag, and they've never been really a caddy before, but all of a sudden they're out on tour with these players.
I think it's a comfort situation for each individual. From the standpoint, I don't know if I could have my wife caddying for me. I love my wife and everything, and I love my kids. But even when I've had my son caddy for me, it's always a little difficult because I know that even though he's not a professional caddy, he knows the game. But on the other hand, you know, he is so close to me that it's almost like we're too close, if that might make sense. But everybody ticks differently. For me, I think it's important to have somebody that you can then trust and you believe in. And, you know, the caddies that I've had, I feel like they've had a big influence on my game. And certainly to be able to win a tournament, I just personally think it's really important to have a caddy that's very level-headed. It doesn't get too high when things are going well and you might be close to the lead, and doesn't get too low if you're having a poor day or you're missing a cut, you know, because all that caddy can do, either a young man or a young woman, whoever's on your bag, can just make sure they're on time, that they're good with the yardages, that they kind of know your tendencies, and, you know, they can't hit a shot for you. I mean, sooner or later, you have to be accountable for the golf that you play.
Well, you have a green jacket from Augusta National, so you get to go back, and do you still play in the par 3 contest? And a lot of people use all sorts of different caddies, especially at that event.
Yeah, that's become a great event. I think what Augusta National and the membership have done there, certainly Billy Payne had a big influence in that, is letting the kids come out, caddy for their parents, friends caddy for their parents, spouses caddy, and it's a very intense week. Obviously, the Masters is the first major championship of the year, and everybody wants to play well or possibly win the Masters and don the green jacket. But in the par 3, they have so many people out there to watch and to spectate. Now that they've opened it up a little bit, it's kind of a relaxing day for the guys before they get started in the tournament.
Well, I want to take you back to one of the great years in your career, 1998. Can you take us through the start of that season? And did you feel, as you kind of closed in on that week at Augusta National, that maybe a green jacket was in your future?
I absolutely thought that there was probably no way that I was ever going to win a major championship. I know that a lot of people, you know, wouldn't have had me higher on their radar screen for sure. I was 41 years old. I wasn't hitting the ball that well. coming to that tournament, I'd played practice rounds with Tiger, and I'd hit it okay. I didn't hit it great, but my confidence was really low. And I think for me, coming close in a couple other majors throughout my career but never winning a major and being on that list of next best players to have never won a major championship, I was flattered to be on that list, to be honest with you. Because when I started playing professional golf, I was just hoping to make a living and win a couple tournaments and do well on the tour. And, you know, certainly at 41, to play and win the Masters, and especially in the fashion, to birdie the last two holes, to make a putt on the 18th green, to win the Masters, and then, you know, have Tiger put the green jacket on me was incredible. And I think what happened was is once you've won one, it doesn't give you the right that you're going to win another one, but it certainly gives you a little bit of confidence. And that summer was a good year, because later that year I went across the pond to the Open Championship at Birkdale and won in a 4-hole playoff over Brian Watts. So to have won two, and then I believe at the PGA I finished third or fourth right behind Vijay, so I had a chance there. So it was a dream year, certainly the icing on the cake for me and my career.
Can you take us through that back nine on Sunday at Augusta? Because it seemed like there was a bunch of guys who probably still to this day are saying, well, maybe I could or should have won it. But it looked like you just broke out of the pack there on the last two holes when you made those birdies.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of guys in the fray. I mean, earlier that day, I remember on the range and playing the first couple holes, Jack Nicklaus hit 56, I believe he was, somewhere around there. Had gotten off to a great start on Sunday. I think he was 4-under through 6 or 7. There was huge crowds, roars out there on the golf course. We knew something special was happening. And then it was kind of between Jim Furyk, myself, Fred Couples, a couple other players that were playing well. There was about 4 or 5 of us that were in the mix. And, you know, I was in the final group with Fred. So it's always kind of a good thing to be in the last group because you can kind of see what's going on in front of you. And really, I think the big turnaround was on the 15th hole, the par 5. At that time, 8-under was posted. That was David Duval. He was in the clubhouse, and we were on the 15th tee, and I was 6-under, and Fred was 6-under par at that time. And Fred went on to make eagle on 15. I made birdie. That pushed me to 7. Fred's now 8. We parred 16, and then 17, I hit a good 9-iron right over the flag to about 12, 13 feet behind the hole and made that putt to get to 8-under. Fred made par, and here we are in the last tee, Fred and I at 8-under, and if we make par, that both of us, there would be a three-way playoff, and I hit a good tee shot on 18, Fred hit it in the left bunker, then he hit it over in the right bunker, and I hit it about that 16, 18 feet right of the hole pin high, and as we walked up to the green, I remember distinctly that I needed some water, because, I mean, look, you're very, very nervous. I mean, I've watched the Masters. I'm a fan of the Masters even to this day, and I've always wondered how anybody, you know, could make a putt on the 18th green to win the Masters. And I remember on the 18th green, I calmed myself down by thinking, you know, Fred's going to hold his bunker shot to get to 9-under. I'm going to have to make this putt to tie Fred. And he didn't. He hit it about 5 feet. And I was lining my putt up. I was thinking to myself, you know, Mark, this is what you play for. Not one time did I ever think that if I make this putt, you know, I'm going to win the Masters. I just don't think you can think that way. I mean, I think you have to believe that you got to go through your routine. I said, you know, sooner or later you're going to have to make a putt, whether it's here on 18 or 10, 11. And the longer it goes on, the more the odds go out of your favor. So why not, you know, put a good stroke on this one and do the best you can? So that was my self-talk as I was walking around lining my putt up on the 18th green. And when I hit my putt, I felt like I hit a good putt. I had no idea what the outcome was going to be. And when I was rolling down there, as everybody stood up and I'm watching it, and it was about 2 feet from the hole, and I distinctly remember, oh my God, you know, it's going to go in. And then it started breaking to the left, and it looked like, you know, my last thought was, you know, please don't lip out. And it caught the left side of the hole and dove in the hole, and my arms and hands went up in the air, and the expression on my face was more shock and disbelief as to what the hell just happened. And truly, I was more in shock and disbelief, and then I realized I had won the Masters.
So then what did that do for you? I mean, obviously you go on and you win the British Open that summer, but what did that do for you from a confidence standpoint as you went into those other majors? You say, hey, maybe I got a little bit of a hang of this major thing down now that I got one.
Well, no, I mean, I think for me and for my career, look, it happened late in my career. Let's face it, I was 41 years old. And I think even to this day, I'm the oldest guy to win two majors in 1 year. But I never, ever, like, consider myself a great player. I always felt like I had a great career for me, but relative to the greats in the game, you know, I never felt like I was one of those. I felt like, look, you know, I mean, people expect Tiger Woods and Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer and, you know, players of that stature to win these major championships, not necessarily Mark O'Meara. So, yeah, it was, it didn't really, I don't think it necessarily changed me as a person, but certainly the notoriety that comes along with winning a major championship was really massive, and even more so today, because, you know, the media attention, and when a player wins a tournament of that size, you know, they're on all these different, I mean, I got in my car and drove over to Hilton Head the next day, so I didn't go out to New York, I didn't go on any talk shows, you know, yes, I'd won the Masters, but it's just a little bit different today than compared to what it was back then.
And you mentioned Tiger puts the jacket on you at Augusta.
Right.
You might be the first guy who had, what, your next-door neighbor actually put the green jacket?
Yeah, that was pretty amazing. You know, to certainly people, it's pretty well documented, our relationship, especially at that time and point in our careers. And I've said this so many times. I mean, I really truly believe that if Tiger hadn't moved into Isleworth when he was 19 and had turned pro, you know, he hadn't won a tournament, and we were friends already, but we became closer friends. And because he came into my life, and because I played and practiced so much with him, I probably wouldn't have won those major championships at 41 if I wasn't around him. And being around that quality of a player, it motivated me.
Can you talk a little bit about your experiences over the years? Long before there was the BMW Championship, we had the Western Open for a long time. What do you remember about playing in the Western Open at Cog Hill? And I'm not sure, you probably got a round or two in over at Butler.
I did. Oh, no, no.
Oh, no.
I mean, listen, I have a long appreciation for the Western Golf Association. I never played in the Western Junior, but I did play in the Western Amateur. Certainly, I played in almost every Western Open every time it came here to Chicago. I loved playing in it. I realized that it was one of the top-tier echelon tournaments on our tour. I never won. I came close a few times. But, yeah, I just well-run, quality golf courses, very good fields. So anybody who's privileged to win a Western Open, that's an important thing to have on your resume.
You know, special thing for the Western Golf Association coming up next year. They're going to go back to where the Western Amateur was played so many times, the Point of Woods. Now, it's missing a lot of trees from probably when you last played there. But what do you remember about Point of Woods, and would you have any advice to an upcoming amateur that will be competing there next summer?
Well, the kids today, let's face it, they're really, really good. I mean, the players of today's generation are powerful. They're solid players. I remember as a young kid in Southern California coming here to play in the Western Amateur and playing at Point of Woods, I thought that Point of Woods was one of the hardest golf courses I'd ever seen. The trees were massive. It was narrow. It was long. Sometimes it was wet. And I just thought it was a very demanding golf course.
And the BMW Championship will be played at Medina. I'm sure you probably have a great memory from Medina or two.
Well, it's one of the world-class golf courses. Medina's got a lot of history to it. I know the BMW is a great championship, and they'll have a great field this next summer. So I think all the players will be excited about the chance to come back and play Medina.
Can you talk a little bit about what you see in the state of golf these days? I mean, there's a lot of talk about everything from clubs to golf balls to guys hitting it a long way to players with different lifestyle habits to stay fit, in shape, and be competitive out on the tours.
Oh, the game has changed for sure. I think a lot of it is, you know, Tiger coming along at the time he did and doing what he has accomplished in the game of golf. Certainly the equipment is better. There's no question about that. But the players are just better. I mean, there's more of them, too. When you take a look at when I played the tour and started in 80, 81, there wasn't that many international players, if any, playing our tour full time. Where now the golf is such a global game that there's so many really great players throughout the world. And yeah, power has really become a big thing, but I think the best way to combat that, in my opinion, would be that you got to force the players to have options and creativity. When you look at some of the great holes in golf, they're like number 10 at Riviera, they're number 12 at Augusta National, they're number the postage stamp at Troon. So we're talking about holes that are actually relatively short but can create havoc to the players. So because the players hit the ball so far, I think lengthening the course is not necessarily always the right suggestion or the right answer. I think you got to force the players to make decisions.
Can you tell us what it was like for you when you got the call to the World Golf Hall of Fame?
Well, I mean, I certainly was pleasantly surprised. I was at home in Houston. It was a rainy day. I remember driving in my truck, and I saw my phone vibrate, and I looked over, and it was Tim Finchem calling, and normally Tim Finch doesn't call me because I usually don't use a lot of foul language on the golf course, and I don't think I've ever been fined in my professional career, so I knew that wasn't probably it, and I was thinking, why is Tim calling me? And I was about ready to go to voicemail, And then I thought, just maybe this is the phone call that I've been waiting for. So I pulled over to the side. I answered. Tim was very gracious. He explained to me about the fact that they were going to St. Andrews for the new induction ceremony in 2015. I knew they had changed the requirements, and I thought that was a great idea that they would do it there at the Hall of, you know, at the Open Championship at St. Andrews. And he said, what's really cool is you're the first call that I've made, you're in. So, I was very emotional. It was a great moment. And then to go to the ceremony, certainly being an Open champion, a former Open champion, played St. Andrews so many times, to have the ceremony there. You know, I went in with David Graham, Laura Davies, A.W. Tillinghast, and myself. So it was, it was a special moment in my life.
You mentioned Laura Davies. She won both women's senior majors this right. year. Did you get a chance to see her play in any of those? It's amazing how well she's
I did. I still follow golf. I love it. I don't get to see it all the time. But, yes, she's a very dynamic player. She's a really wonderful lady, very powerful, but still very competitive.
And can you talk a little bit about your golf plans for 2019, where you still may get out on the course and compete a little bit?
Yeah, no, I think this year I played about 17 events on the Champions Tour. I'd give myself a B-, C+. I'll continue to play another year. I played my last Masters last year. After I finished and missed the cut on Friday, I announced that I was finished with playing there. I felt like it was just time for me to walk away. I don't feel like I had anything to prove. The golf course is big. It's very demanding, and I don't want to go out and shoot 74 to 78 or 80. I didn't see the point. And 2 years prior, a year and a half prior, I played my last Open Championship when I was 60 at Birkdale. So that was a great way to go out. And next year, I'll play a limited schedule on the Champions Tour. You know, I have so many hobbies that I love to do. I love being in the river. I'm an avid fly fisherman. I love to ride my snowmobile in the wintertime up in the backcountry. So, you know, but I still love to compete. You know, and I still want to try to get better, even at almost 62 years of age.